doubled up themselves. None of them wanted to get near her. Late in the afternoon, they stopped to rest the animals in a canyon surrounded by red rock mesas. The old men discussed how to get rid of her. Nobody said so, but they all knew that they couldn't simply turn her loose or leave her behind, tied to a tree. They were in trouble now. They would kill her as soon as they found somebody who knew how it should be done. The old men discussed the stupidity of the young men in tones of great contempt. "It's a good thing for us we're near old Deshini's place," one of them said. "We can get him to help us." Early the next morning, they rode into the Chuska Mountains. They stopped at the White Clay Springs and sent someone up the hill to find Deshini. They looked at the Mexican captive, and then at the burrows loaded with meat. They wondered how much Deshini would charge to get them out of the situation. Deshini's wives came down the hill first. They watched curiously, and then walked back up the trail. "What does she look like?" he asked his wives before they could speak. "Who?" they said, pretending not to understand him the way they often did, trying to anger him. But he smiled this time, and got up from his place by the door. "Don't give me any trouble, ladies," he said, putting on his old badger fur hat and reaching for his walking cane. "Or I think I'll marry her." Deshini stood on the trail above the spring and watched her. She was kneeling at the edge of the pool, washing herself. Deshini came down to the hunters who pretended to be adjusting the harnesses and tightening the cinches. "Nice load of meat you have there," he said, motioning toward the bundles with his chin. "May have something else, too, you might have noticed," the tall man said casually. "She's quite valuable, but she slows us down. You know how they are, crying and screaming." Deshini smiled at the lies. He shook his head. "I can see what you have. I will help you out for 2 or 3 loads of meat. Otherwise..." His voice trailed off, and the hunters started whispering among themselves. He knew some Spanish. "I'm too old to bother with you," he said. "Tomorrow we'll take you back to your people. We'll assure them that you haven't been touched by the men. You can go back to your former life." Deshini was pleased with himself. He thought the words sounded suitably generous and sensitive. He watched her face. It was unchanged. "We'll tell your people where you were found. It was up in a tree, wasn't it? In the hills, late at night." She laughed at him. Her nostrils flared and her face was sneering. "You know the answer, old man. Don't play games with me. You know what the people there will do with me." "Me don't want that thing around here," the three sisters told their husband. "It's a disgrace the way you sleep with her every night. We try to teach our children to avoid touching alien things, but every day they see you do it, you senile old man." So he moved her to the winter house below the mountains in the southwest, where the yellow sand rock foothills look over on the river. In the middle of the night, he heard her moving in the hogan, the soft sounds of basket lids lifted and buckskin bundles unrolling, the rustle of seeds and dry leaves, and the clink of eagle claws and wolf's teeth taken on their strings from his bag. Then there was silence. "I hear you, old man. Go back to sleep." "I get cold without you close to me. Come, lay down again." "I will if you tell me why I hear so many voices in this hogan at night. All these languages I never heard before." "Come lay down now. I'm shivering." She lay down beside him and pulled the blanket over her mouth and gradually moved closer to him until she could feel his thin ribs moving up and down. Old Deshini's heart still pounded when he heard her breathing, and the excitement crawled up his thighs to his belly in anticipation. "I think it's them again."
"Yes."
"They're working for the end of this world, aren't they?"
"I think so."
"Sometimes I don't know if the ceremony will be strong enough to stop them.
We have to depend on people not even born yet, 100 years from now."
She could only whisper the words because he was holding her close to him now.
"You Mexicans have no patience," he said, stroking her belly. "It never has been easy. It will take a long, long time, and many more stories like this one before they are laid low." She rolled over on top of him quickly. "There is something else which takes a long time happening," she said in a low voice. "Why do I bother to lay down with you, old man?" Old age made him fearless. He flexed the old chants and the beliefs like a mountain oak bow. He'd been watching the sky before she came, the planets and constellations wheeling and shifting the patterns of the old stories. He saw the transition, and he was ready. Some of the old singers could see new shadows across the moon. They could make out new darkness between the stars. They sent to Sheenie the patients they couldn't cure, the victims of this new evil set loose upon the world. He reasoned that because it was set loose by witchery of all the world, and brought to them by the whites, the ceremony against it must be the same. When she came, she didn't fool him for long. She had come for his ceremonies, for the chants and the stories they grew from. "This is the only way," she told him. "It cannot be done alone. We must have power from everywhere, even the power we can get from the whites." Although the people detected changes in the ceremonies Deshini performed, they tolerated them because of his acknowledged power to aid victims tainted by Christianity or liquor. But after the Mexican captive came, they were terrified, and few of them stayed to see the conclusion of his ceremonies. But by then, Deshini was getting ready to die anyway, and he couldn't be bothered with isolated cures. He gazed into his smoky quartz crystal, and she stared into the fire. And they plotted the course of the ceremony by the direction of dark night winds, and by the colors of the clay in drought-ridden valleys. "The day I was born, they saw the color of my eyes, and they took me from the village. The Spaniards in the town looked at me, and the Catholic priest said, 'Let her die.' They blamed the root woman for this birth, and they told her to leave the village before dark. She waited until they had gone, and she went to the old trash pile in the arroyo where they left me. She took me north to El Paso, and years later she laughed about how long she had waited for me in that village full of dirty, stupid people. Sometimes she was bitter because of what they had done to her in the end, after all the years she had helped them. 'Sometimes I have to shake my head,' she'd say, 'because human beings deserve exactly what they get.'" The people asked, "Did you find him?"
"Yes, but we forgot something.
Tobacco."
"But there was no tobacco. So Fly and Hummingbird had to fly all the way back down to the fourth world below to ask our mother where they could get some tobacco. 'We came back again,' they told our mother. 'Maybe you need something?'"
"Tobacco."
"Go ask Caterpillar." There was a child. The Mexican woman gave her to Deshini's daughters to raise. The half-sisters taught her to fear her mother. Many years later, she had a child. When I was weaned, my grandmother came and took me. My mother and my old aunts didn't resist because it had all been settled before Deshini died. Bettoni paused and blew smoke rings up at the sky. Teo stretched out his legs in front of him. He was thinking about the ceremony the medicine man had performed over him, testing it against the old feeling, the sick hollow in his belly formed by the memories of Rocky and Josiah, and all the years of Auntie's eyes and her teeth set hard on edge. He could feel the ceremony like the rawhide thongs of the medicine pouch, straining to hold back the voices, the dreams, faces in the jungle and the L.A. depot, the smoky silence of solid white walls.
"One night or nine nights won't do it anymore," the medicine man said. The ceremony isn't finished yet.
He was drawing in the dirt with his finger.
Remember these stars, he said. I've seen them, and I've seen the spotted cattle. I've seen a mountain, and I've seen a woman.
The wind came up and caught the sleeves of Teo's shirt. He smelled wood, smoke, and sage in the old man's clothes. He reached for the billfold in his hip pocket. I want to pay you for the ceremony you did tonight. Old Batoni shook his head.
This has been going on for a long, long time now. It's up to you. Don't let them stop you. Don't let them finish off this world.
The dry skin was still stuck to his body, but the effects of the witchery, of the evil thing, began to leave his body. The effects of the witchery, of the evil thing in his surroundings, began to turn away. It had gone a great distance. It had gone below the north. The truck driver stopped at San Fidel to dump a load of diesel fuel. Teo went inside the station to buy candy. He hadn't eaten since he left Batoni and his helper up in the mountains. The room smelled like rubber from the loops of fan belts hanging from the ceiling. Cases of motor oil were stacked in front of the counter. The cans had a dull oil film on them. The desk behind the counter was covered with yellow and pink slips of paper, invoices and bills with a half cup of cold coffee sitting on top of them. Above the desk, on a calendar, a smiling blonde girl in a baton twirler's shiny blue suit with white boots to her knees had her arms flung around the neck of a Palomino horse. She was holding a bottle of Coca-Cola in one hand. He stared at the calendar for a long time. The horse's mane was bleached white, and there was no trace of dust on its coat. The hooves were waxed with dark polish, shining like metal. The woman's eyes and the display of her teeth made him remember the glassy eyes of the stuffed bobcat above the bar in Bebo. The teeth were the same. He turned away from the calendar. He felt sick, like a walking shadow, faint and wispy, his sense of balance still swaying from the ride in the cab of the tank truck. All the windows of the candy machine had red sold-out flags in them. The station man came inside. He looked at Teo suspiciously, as if he thought Teo might be drunk or in there to steal something. In his anger, Teo imagined movie images of himself turning the pockets of his jeans inside out, unbuttoning his shirt to prove he had stolen nothing. The confrontation would have been too easy, and he wasn't going to let them stop him. He asked the man where he could buy some candy.
Down the road, he said, not looking up from the cash register.
His milky white face was shaded with the stubble of a red beard. There were white hairs scattered among the red, and the skin across his forehead and at the corner of each eye was wrinkled, as if he had been frowning for a long time. The backs of his hands were covered with curly reddish hair. The fingers were black and oily. He had never seen a white person so clearly before. He had to turn away. All those things old Batoni had told him were swirling inside his head, doing strange things. He wanted to laugh. He wanted to laugh at the station man who didn't even know that his existence and the existence of all white people had been conceived by witchery. He told the truck driver he didn't need to ride any farther. The sun was behind him, and a warm, dry wind from the southwest was blowing enough to cool the sweat on his forehead and to dry out the wet cloth under the arms of his shirt. He walked down the ditch beside the highway, below the shoulder of the highway. He didn't want any more rides. He wanted to walk until he recognized himself again. Grasshoppers buzzed out of the weeds ahead of him. They were fading to a dry yellow color, from their bright green color of spring. Their wings flashed reflections of sun when they jumped. He looked down at the weeds and grass. He stepped carefully, pushing the toe of his boot into the weeds first to make sure the grasshoppers were gone before he set his foot down into the crackling, leathery stalks of dead sunflowers. Across the highway, behind the bar at Cerritos, there was a big cornfield, but the plants were short and thin,
and their leaves were faded yellow like the grasshoppers. There would be only a few cobs on each plant, and the kernels would be small and deformed. He wondered what the Mexicans at Cubero thought. Their cattle were thin, too. What did they do? Drop down on their knees in the chapel, sweaty straw hats in their hands, to smell the candle wax and watch the flickering red and blue votive lights? Pray up to the plaster Jesus in rose-colored robes, his arms reaching out? Help us, forgive us? He heard a truck slowing down on the highway behind him. He turned around and saw Harley hanging out the window, waving at him. He swung the door open before the old green truck had come to a stop and stumbled out of the seat grinning, holding a bottle of Garden Deluxe Tokay in each hand. Harley patted him on the back and pushed him toward the truck. Teo could see Leroy was driving, but there was someone else in the truck, someone sitting in the middle, between them.
"Hey, buddy, meet Helen Jean," Harley said, and winked crookedly, as if he had been drinking for a while.
She was wearing tight blue western pants and a frilly pink western blouse. She didn't say anything, but she smiled and moved closer to Leroy. Leroy grinned at Teo. She rubbed her leg against Leroy, but she was staring out the window while she did it, as if her mind were somewhere else. Leroy and Harley were happy. They had wine and 2 six-packs, and they didn't watch her the way Teo did. Her perfume was close and heavy. Breathing it was like swallowing big red roses. It choked him. He turned his face to the fresh air rushing in the window.
"Good thing you're skinny, buddy. Otherwise we couldn't shut the door."
Leroy shifted through the gears. The woman grinned at him because she was straddling the gear stick, and he kept brushing against her thigh whenever he shifted gears. Harley nudged her in the ribs with an elbow and offered her the bottle.
"Look at her. She drinks like a pro," Harley said, delighted. "We found her in Gallup last night, didn't we?"
Leroy nodded. His eyes were bloodshot. Harley passed him the bottle. Teo shook his head.
"You want a beer?"
Teo shook his head and pointed to his stomach.
"Sick? Hey, Leroy, this guy says he's sick. We know how to cure him, don't we, Helen Jean?"
She nodded. Teo could see the lines at the corners of her eyes and a slight curve of flesh under her chin. Her hair was short and curled tight, and her eyelashes were stiff with mascara. She kept reaching into her tooled leather purse between her feet for her lipstick, rubbing it back and forth until her lips were thick and red. She wasn't much older than they were. Teo leaned out the window to make more room in the cab, but Harley, Helen Jean, and Leroy enjoyed squeezing close. He wanted to be still walking, but he knew them too well. It was no use to refuse a ride from them when they were drunk, because they'd follow him along the shoulder of the highway for 10 miles in low gear until he got in with them. He wanted to catch a grasshopper and hold it close to his face, to look at its big flat eyes and shiny thin legs with stripes of black and brown like beadwork, making tiny intricate designs. The last time he held one, Rocky was with him, and they had stained their fingertips brown with the tobacco juice the grasshoppers spit.
"Hey," Harley said, "what you watching?"
"Grasshoppers?" She giggled. Harley shook his head and made him hold the wine bottle.
"Here, you better have some. You're in bad shape, isn't he, Leroy? Watching grasshoppers, and we've got Helen Jean here to watch, eh?"
He laughed again. The bottle was sticky. It was almost empty. He watched the weeds in the ditch speeding by. In another month, the grasshoppers would be dead. Autumn wind and old age would chill them bone white, leaving their hollow shells to swirl with the dry leaves in the ditch.
"Hey, you like my truck?"
Teo nodded.
"Where'd you get it?"
"No money down. Pay it the first of the month."
"If they catch him,"
Harley laughed.
"Yeah, they have to catch me first."
Harley bounced up and down on the seat, laughing.
"They owed it to us. We traded it for some of the land they stole from us."
Helen Jean didn't smile, but she said,
Gypped you again. This thing isn't even worth a half acre.
Teo laughed then, too, because it was true. He could smell fumes from a loud, busted muffler, and he was going to make a joke about how the white people sold junk pickups to Indians so they could drive around until they asphyxiated themselves. But it wasn't that funny. Not really. They were getting close to Laguna, crossing the overpass by New Laguna. Leroy shifted into second gear for the hill.
"Thanks for the ride," Teo said. "You can let me out any place along here."
He gave the wine bottle to Helen Jean. She steadied it between her thighs and pulled the cork out again.
"Easy, easy," she said to Leroy. "You guys already spilled one bottle all over me."
She was either an Apache or a Ute. Her face was angular, and something about her nose and eyes reminded him of a hawk. Leroy slowed down and pulled off the right shoulder of the highway.
"Hey, wait! He's going with us, aren't you, Teo? Huh, buddy?"
Harley had Teo by the arm and was leaning close to him, breathing wine fumes in his face. Harley was sweating, and his face was shiny. They had been friends for a long time. They were the only ones left now. He hesitated, and Harley saw it. He started whooping and slapping Teo on the back. Leroy revved up the engine and threw it into a low gear. The rear wheels spun sand and pebbles against the fenders, and the truck skidded and swerved back on the pavement. He did a speed shift into second gear and gunned it across the bridge, up the hill past Willie Krieger's garage. Helen Jean squealed and laughed because Leroy's driving threw them hard against each other. Harley had his arms around her neck, bellowing out war whoops and laughs. The old truck was vibrating hard. The steering was loose, and the front end wandered across the white line into the other lane. And each time a car was coming at them head-on before Leroy wrestled the wheel around and steered the truck over again. White people selling Indians junk cars and trucks reminded Teo of the army captain in the 1860s who made a gift of wool blankets to the Apaches. The entire stack of blankets was infected with smallpox. But he was laughing anyway, the bumps shaking laughter out of him like feathers out of an old pillow, until he was limp and there were tears in his eyes.
"We'll give you a cure. We know how, don't we?"
Harley was bouncing on the seat, and he made the whole truck sway on its weak springs. Helen Jean squealed, and the bottle of wine she was holding splashed all over them. Teo grabbed it and swallowed what was left in the bottle.
"Drink it! Drink it! It's good for you! You'll get better! Get this man to the Cold Corps Hospital! Hurry up!"
Leroy pressed the gas pedal to the floorboard, and the speedometer dial spun around and around before it fluttered at 65. The engine whined with the strain, and the heat gauge needle was pointing at 212. Teo could smell hot oil and rubber, but Leroy kept it wide open past Mesita. Up ahead he could see where the highway dipped across an arroyo, but Leroy didn't slow down, and the old truck bounced and landed hard on the other side of the dip. Their heads hit the roof of the cab, and Harley said this was better than a carnival ride at the Laguna Fiesta. Teo sank down into sensations, the truck vibrating and bouncing down the road, the bodies squeezed around him tight, the smell of perfume and sweat and wine, and the rushing fresh air cooling the sweat. Everything made them laugh, until they were laughing at their own noises and laughter. He didn't have to remember anything. He didn't have to feel anything but this, and he wished the truck would never stop moving, that they could ride like that forever. Leroy parked the truck under the elm trees at the Y Bar. Wine bottles and beer cans were scattered everywhere, broken and flattened by tires. Leroy turned off the key, but he left it in gear, so when he took his foot off the clutch, the truck lurched forward suddenly. Harley was helping Helen Jean get out, and the sudden lurch threw her against him. They both collapsed on the ground, laughing. The contents of her tooled leather purse with the rose designs had spilled all around her. She picked up her billfold, but they all got down on their hands and knees, crawling around to pick up little brass tubes of lipstick and her mirror and powder puff. Harley grabbed the mirror out of her hand
and pranced around one of the elm trees, pretending to be chickish muggy, someone who swished around, exercising his back muscles as he walked.
"Hey, Harley," Teo yelled.
"You can't fool us anymore. We know you're one of those guys. Where's your lipstick and nail polish?" Harley took mincing steps and dropped the mirror into Helen's purse. "I'll race you to a cold beer," he said, as he took off, running to the door of the bar. Harley and Leroy raced for the screen door, leaving Teo behind with Helen Jean. She was giggling to herself, taking big steps and setting her feet down stiffly, as though she weren't sure the ground would hold her. They stepped over a Navajo, sleeping on the shady side of the wooden steps. The jukebox was playing a Mexican polka, and Harley was dancing around by himself. There were some Mexicans from the section gang drinking beer at a table in the corner, and three Navajos slouching on stools at the bar. The Mexicans could see she was drunk, and they were already getting ideas about her. The way the men looked at her tensed Teo's hands into fists. He didn't feel the fun or the laughter anymore. His back was rigid. He sat down stiffly in the chair Leroy pulled out for him. Harley kept Helen Jean between himself and Teo and away from Leroy. He should have been worrying about the Mexicans in the corner, not Leroy. But Harley was up again, ordering a round of Coors, feeding quarters into the jukebox as he punched the buttons for all the Hank Williams songs. Helen Jean was smiling coyly at one of the Mexicans. Teo tried to focus his eyes in the dim light to see which one, but there was a buzzing inside his head that made his eyes lose focus. He swallowed more beer, trying to clear away the dull ache. And he decided then he was too tired to care what she did.
"It wouldn't have worked anyway," Harley was saying in a loud voice. "Between this beer belly of mine and her big belly, there would have been too much distance."
He laughed and looked at Helen Jean to see if she liked his story. She moved her eyes away quickly from the tall Mexican with long sideburns. She stared down at the table, smiling to herself. The Mexicans stood up. The tall one put his cap on slowly and pulled it to one side of his head seductively. He watched her steadily. He didn't care if the Indians noticed. He nodded, and she smiled. Harley had the bottle tilted all the way, nursing the last drops of beer. He was too drunk and too happy to see what was happening. Leroy's shirt tail was coming loose from his jeans, and when he answered Harley, he had trouble making the words come out. Helen Jean reached down by her feet for her purse. She hesitated and looked at Teo. She giggled and said,
"I have to go pee."
He nodded and finished off the beer. Harley and Leroy never even saw her go. She'd been thinking about it that morning when they left Gallup. Something had reminded her. Maybe it was the people in the bar talking about the Gallup ceremonial coming in 2 weeks. She'd left Towoc about then, August, 1 year ago. Left the reservation for good to find a job. She hadn't thought about it until then. Maybe it was because she was with these reservation Indians, out drinking with them and dancing at Gallup with all the other reservation Indians. Maybe someone had even talked about Towoc. She took the money she'd saved, money the missionary lady paid her for cooking, and she stopped by Emma's to tell them goodbye. But the padlock was hooked through the hasp on the door, and it was locked, which meant Emma would be gone all day. Maybe to Cortez. So she left without seeing her little sisters, because she planned to come back on the bus every weekend to visit, and to bring money to help them out. These Laguna guys were about the worst she'd run into, especially that guy they picked up walking along the highway. He acted funny. Too quiet, and not very friendly. She wanted to get away from them. They weren't mean like the two Oklahoma guys who beat her up one afternoon in a parked car behind the El Fidel. Pawnees, they said. Normandy, Omaha Beach. They beat her up, took turns holding and hitting her. They yelled at her because they both wanted her. They'd been buddies all through the war together, and she was trying to split them up, they said. These Lagunas wouldn't beat her up, except she didn't know for sure about the quiet one. But Harley and Leroy, they were okay.
She just didn't want to be driving around, way out in the sticks with these reservation guys, even if they were war vets. It was just a feeling she'd had since that morning, thinking about ceremonial time coming again. She hadn't sent any letters to Emma or the girls. She meant to do it. She'd even written letters in the evenings on Stephanie's pink stationery at the little table in the kitchen they all shared. But she saved the letters in unsealed envelopes, waiting for a couple of dollar bills to send along. It didn't work out. Her roommates were nice, but they had to have rent money, and she had to buy her share of the food. All day one Saturday, the girls gave each other curly permanent waves and plucked out their eyebrows, penciling a thin arc over each eye. Monday, she borrowed Elaine's blue dress, and she went down to the chemo theater to apply for the job they advertised in the theater window. The man told her to wait in the lobby. It smelled like cold popcorn and burned-out cigarettes. She was too shy to ask him what the job was or to tell him she knew how to type. She looked at the doors marked private and office and tried to imagine what the desks looked like and what kind of typewriter they had. He didn't smile or look at her directly.
"You can start today," he said, "but you might want to change your clothes."
She stood in front of him, afraid to ask what was wrong with her clothes. He turned and motioned for her to follow. At the end of the corridor, he pulled open a door, and she saw a push broom and a scrub bucket. "Oh," she said. She always smiled when she was embarrassed. "How much do you pay?"
75 cents an hour," he said, walking away.
These Laguna guys were fun, all right, and they sure spent their money. She didn't even know if there would be any money left when she asked them to help her out a little. Her roommates got tired of helping her out. They thought she was a secretary. They kept asking her what she did with all her money. She lied. She said she had to send it back home to Emma and the girls. She got dressed every day and left for work when they did. She changed her clothes in the ladies' lounge, but it wasn't working out. The man at the theater waited for her now. He watched her go down to the ladies' lounge. She wasn't surprised the day she heard the door open and close and she saw his brown shoes under the door of the toilet stall. These Indians who fought in the war were full of stories about all the places they'd seen. San Diego, Oakland, Germany, the Philippines. The first time she heard them talk, she believed everything. That was right after she got to town and the girls took her out one weekend. She'd walked around, staring up at the tall buildings and all the big neon signs on Central Avenue. Every time she rode an elevator, then, she thought of the old people at home, who shook their heads at the mention of elevators and tall buildings or jukeboxes that could play 100 different records. The old Utes said it was a lie. There were no such things. But she saw it every day, and for a long time when she saw these things, she felt embarrassed for the old people at home who didn't believe in these things. So she was careful not to make the same kind of mistake herself, and she believed all the stories the guys told. They had ribbons and medals they carried in their wallets, and if the U.S. government decorated them, they must be okay. She knew where to find them, which downtown bars they liked. She knew the veterans' disability checks came out around the first of the month. She learned these things after she quit her job at the chemo. She walked by the El Fidel that day she quit, and she could hear them laughing and whooping it up inside, so she knew they were Indians. That day she went in only to ask for a loan, because the girls were getting behind with the rent. The guys told her to sit down. She asked for a Coke, and they told the bartender to put rum in it.
"How do you like that?" they said, laughing and patting each other on the back. "Nothing like this at Towak, huh?"
She sat with them all afternoon. It was dim in there, and cool because they had a table near the fan. In July, the streets and sidewalks were too hot to touch. She looked for work, but every day when it started to get hot, she walked past the El Fidel to see who was there. They were happy to see her. They introduced her to their other buddies. Late in the afternoon, when she got up to leave, she would ask someone to help her out a little. By then, they would be feeling pretty good. Someone always helped her out with $5 or maybe $10.
We used to do this every night during the war, one of them told her. In San Diego one time, we bought the whole bar, all the soldiers and their girls, a round of drinks. That bartender shook his head. He told us, I know it's you Indians without even looking. No one ever did that until the Indian soldiers came around.
They told her other stories, too. Later on, when they started looking at her and sitting closer to her. The sergeant from Isleta still wore his khaki shirt with the stripes on the arm. As he reached over to pour her more beer, he rubbed his shaky arm against her side to feel the swell of her breast. She wasn't surprised then, either. She knew if they helped her out, they would get friendly with her, too. He'd already told her a story about blowing up a bunker full of Japs. The story ended with him pulling out his wallet to show her a little bronze star and a blue ribbon.
Another thing was the women. The white women in California. Boy, you never saw anything like it. They couldn't get enough of us, huh? No, all the others at the table would shout. See, the sergeant said, looking a little crookedly at her. I'll tell you about this one who was in love with me. He nodded deliberately. Yeah, she was. I told her I was already married back home, but she didn't care. Boy, you should have seen her blonde hair. She had it all curled, and she was built like this up front.
He held his brown hands out in front of his chest and grinned at the others. He turned back to her and breathed heavily into her ear.
Hey, let's go someplace where I can tell you about it.
But she didn't want to go with him.
Tell me here, she said. I want to finish my drink. Her name was Doreen. She only needed the money because her mother was a cripple. She wasn't like the others. She went with me because she loved me. I could still have her if I went back to California.
One of the guys at the table, an Apache, yelled at the Isleta sergeant.
She told that to all the guys. Doreen, that's what she called herself. Sure she liked Indians because they were dumb guys like you.
The Apache had been watching Helen Jean. He'd been watching the Isleta rub up against her. The Isleta grabbed her arm.
Let's go, he said.
She didn't move. The Apache jumped up, ready to fight.
She doesn't want to go with you, the Apache said.
The Isleta turned to her. His eyes were pinched with rage.
You bitch. You think you're better than a white woman?
He slapped her across the face. Her teeth cut her tongue and the inside of her mouth. Tears ran down her face. The Apache grabbed him and they started pushing at each other in a staggering circle on the dance floor. The other guys were cheering for a fight. They forgot about her. She knew all the stories about white women in San Diego and Oakland and L.A. Always blonde or redhead. Nice girls with sick or crippled parents at home. Didn't make any difference to her. They drank until they couldn't walk without holding on to her. She asked them for money then, money to send back to Emma at Towak for the little girls. Then they stumbled up the steps to the Hudson Hotel. If she took long enough in the toilet, they usually passed out on the bed. Even in the wintertime, when the rooms at the Hudson were cold and the window by the bed had frost on it, they sweated beer. And they lay on her so heavily that it was difficult to breathe. Their mouths were wet and soured with beer, and when they pushed themselves down on her, they felt small and soft between her thighs. She stared at the stains on the ceiling and waited until they gave up or fell asleep, and then she rolled out from under them. She looked at these Laguna guys. They'd been treated first class once with their uniforms. As long as there had been a war and the white people were afraid of the Japs and Hitler. But these Indians got fooled when they thought it would last. She was tired of pretending with them, tired of making believe it had lasted. It was almost a year since she had left Towak. There was something about Gallup that made her think about it. She didn't like the looks of the Indian women she saw in Gallup, dancing at Eddie's club with the drunks that stumbled around the floor with them. Their hair was dirty and straight. They'd shaved off their eyebrows, but the hairs were growing back, and they didn't bother to pencil them anymore. Their blouses had buttons missing and were fastened with safety pins. Their western pants were splitting out at the seams. There were stains around the crotch. She reached into her purse for the little pink compact and looked in the mirror. Her hair was cut short and was tightly curled. It needed to be washed, but at least it wasn't long or straight. She touched up her left eyebrow and put on lipstick. She didn't like the looks of the country around here either. Rocks and sand, arroyos and no trees. After spending all her life at Towak, she didn't need to be wasting her time there, in the middle of nowhere, someplace worse than the reservation she had left. If she hung around any longer with these guys, that's how she'd end up, like the rest of the Indians. She smiled at the Mexican. He winked at her. He had the cash from his railroad paycheck on the table in front of him. He'd help her out, give her some to send back to Towak. And this time she was really going to send some money to Emma, and she wasn't going to waste any more time fooling around with Indian war heroes. He sat back in the chair and rested his head against the cool plaster wall. Through the sound of the jukebox, he could hear the Navajo, sitting now with his back against the screen door, singing songs. There was something familiar in the songs, and he remembered old Batoni's singing. Something in his belly stirred faintly, but it was too far away now. He crawled deeper into the black, gauzy web where he could rest in the silence, where his coming and going through this world was no more than a star falling across the night sky. He left behind the pain and buzzing in his head. They were shut out by the wide, dark distance. Someone was yelling. Someone was shaking him out of the tall tree he was in. He thought it might be old Batoni telling him to get on his way, telling him that he'd slept too long, and there were the cattle to find, and the stars, the mountain, and the woman. He started to answer old Batoni to tell him he hadn't forgotten. "I'm going," he said.
"You're damn right you're going," the white man said. "Your pal just got the shit kicked out of him, and I don't want no more trouble here."
The last bright rays of sunlight split his head in half, like a big axe splitting logs for winter kindling. He put his hand over his eyes to shade them. He moved down the steps carefully, remembering the Navajo who had been sitting there, singing. But he was gone, and the Mexicans were gone, too. And the sky was deep orange and scarlet all the way across to Mount Taylor. Leroy was kneeling over Harley, balancing himself unsteadily with one hand. His shirt tail was loose, making a little skirt around his slim hips. He was saying, "Harley, buddy, did they hurt you?" Leroy's lips were bloody and swollen where they'd hit him. Harley was breathing peacefully, passed out or knocked out, Teo couldn't tell. There was a big cut above his left eyebrow, but the blood had already crusted over it. They carried Harley to the truck, his legs dragged behind him, wobbling and leaving long toe marks in the dirt. They propped him up between them, with Teo behind the wheel. Leroy was slumped against the door, passed out. He searched the dashboard for the knob to turn on the headlights. When he pulled it, the knob came loose in his hands. He was too tired and sick to laugh at this truck, but he would have if Helen Jean had been there, because she said it. Gypped again. At twilight, the earth was darker than the sky, and it was difficult to see if any of Romero's sheep or goats were grazing along the edge of the pavement. The tourist traffic on Highway 66 was gone now, and Teo imagined white people eating their mashed potatoes and gravy in some steamy Grant's Cafe. During that last summer, they had ridden across these flats to round up the speckled cattle and brand the calves. He took the pickup across the dip slowly, almost tenderly, as if the old truck were the blind white mule, too old to be treated roughly anymore. He was thinking about Harley and Leroy, about Helen Jean and himself. How much longer would they last? How long before one of them got stabbed in a bar fight, not just knocked out? How long before this old truck swerved off the road or head on into a bus? But it didn't make much difference anyway. The drinking and hell-raising were just things they did, as he had done sitting at the ranch all afternoon, watching the yellow cat bite the air for flies, passing the time away, waiting for it to end. Someone groaned. He looked over to see who it was. He smelled vomit. Harley had thrown up all over himself. Teo rolled down the window and drove with his head outside, the way train engineers did, the air rushing at his face as he watched the white lines of the highway fall past the truck. He pulled off the highway at Mesita and reached over and shook Leroy by the arm. He mumbled and pushed Teo's hand away. He shut off the engine and looked at the village. The lights of the houses were as scattered and dim as faraway stars. He left the keys in the ignition and rolled up the window in case the wind blew that night. One of them had pissed, and the rubber mat at Leroy's feet was wet, and with the windows rolled up, the urine smell steamed around him. He gagged as he pushed the door open, and something gave way in his belly. He vomited out everything he had drunk with them, and when that was gone, he was still kneeling on the road beside the truck, holding his heaving belly, trying to vomit out everything. All the past. All his life. The scalp ceremony laid to rest the Japanese souls in the green, humid jungles, and it satisfied the female giant who fed on the dreams of warriors. But there was something else now, as Batoni said. It was everything they had seen. The cities, the tall buildings, the noise and the lights, the power of their weapons and machines. They were never the same after that. They had seen what the white people had made from the stolen land. It was the story of the white shell beads all over again. The white shell beads stolen from a grave and found by a man as he walked along a trail one day. He carried the beautiful white shell beads on the end of a stick, because he suspected where they came from. He left them hanging in the branches of a piñon tree, and although he had never touched them, they haunted him. All he could think of, all he dreamed of, were these white shell beads hanging in that tree. He couldn't eat and he couldn't work. He lost touch with the life he had lived before the day he found those beads, and the man he had been before that day was lost somewhere on that trail where he first saw the beads. Every day they had to look at the land, from horizon to horizon, and every day the loss was with them. It was the dead unburied, and the mourning of the lost going on forever. So they tried to sink the loss in booze, and silence their grief with war stories about their courage, defending the land they had already lost. He followed the wagon road to Laguna, going by memory and the edges of old ruts. The air was cool, and he could smell the dampness that came out with the stars. Old Batoni might explain it this way, Teo didn't know for sure. There were transitions that had to be made in order to become whole again, in order to be the people our mother would remember. Transitions, like the boy walking in bear country being called back softly. Up north, around Reedleaf Town, there was this Kokoyo magician they called Kaopata, or the gambler. He was tall, and he had a handsome face, but he always wore spruce greens around his head, over his eyes. He dressed in the finest white buckskins. His moccasins were perfectly sewn. He had strings of sky-blue turquoise, strings of red coral in his ears. In all ways, the gambler was very good to look at. His house was high in the peaks of the Zuni Mountains, and he waited for people to wander up to his place. He kept the gambling sticks all stacked up, ready for them. He walked and turned around for them to show off his fancy clothes and expensive beads. Then he told them he would gamble with them. Their clothes, their beads, for his. Most people wore their old clothes when they went hunting in the mountains, so they figured they didn't have much to lose. Anyway, they might win all his fine things. Not many could pass up his offer. But the people didn't know. They ate the blue cornmeal he offered them. They didn't know he mixed human blood with it. Visitors who ate it didn't have a chance. He got power over them that way. And when they started gambling with him, they didn't stop until they lost everything they owned. And when they were naked, and he had everything, he'd say,
I tell you what. Since I'm so good and generous, I'll give you one last chance. See that rawhide bag hanging on the north wall over there? If you can guess what is in that bag, I'll give you back all your clothes and beads and everything I have here, too. These feather blankets, all these strings of coral beads, these fine white buckskin moccasins. But if you don't guess right, you lose your life. They were in his power. They had lost everything. It was their last chance. So they usually said, okay. But they never guessed what was in the bag. He hung them upside down in his storeroom, side by side with the other victims. He cut out their hearts and let their blood run down into the bins of blue cornmeal. That is what the Kokoyo Kaupata gambler did up there in the Zuni Mountains. And one time he even captured the storm clouds. He won everything from them, but since they can't be killed, all he could do was lock them up in four rooms of his house. The clouds of the east in the east room, the clouds of the south in the south room, the clouds of the west in the west room, the clouds of the north in the north room. The sun is their father. Every morning he wakes them up. But one morning he went first to the north top of the west mountain, then to the west top of the south mountain, and then to the south top of the east mountain, and finally, it was on the east top of the north mountain he realized they were gone. For 3 years the storm clouds disappeared while the gambler held them prisoners. The land was drying up. The people and animals were starving. They are his children, so he went looking for them. He took blue pollen and yellow pollen. He took tobacco and coral beads, and he walked into the open country below the mesas. There, in a sandy place by a blue flower vine, Spider Woman was waiting for him. "Grandson," she said. "I hear your voice," he answered, "but where are you?" "Down here, by your feet." He looked down at the ground and saw a little hole. "I brought you something, Grandma." "Why, thank you, grandson. I can always use these things," she said. "The storm clouds are missing." "That Kokoyo Kaupata, the gambler, has them locked up," she told him. "How will I get them back?" "It won't be easy, grandson, but here, take this medicine. Blow it on the gambler's black ducks who guard his place. Take him by surprise. The next thing is, don't eat anything he offers you. Go ahead. Gamble with him. Let him think he has you, too. Then he will make you his offer. Your life for a chance to win everything, even his life. He will say, 'What do I have hanging in that leather bag on my east wall?' You say, 'Maybe some shiny pebbles.' Then you pause a while and say, 'Let me think.' Then guess again. Say, 'Maybe some mosquitoes.' He'll begin to rub his flint blade and say, 'This is your last chance.' But this time, you will guess the Pleiades. He'll jump up and say, 'Heheya, you were the first to guess.' Next, he will point to a woven cotton bag hanging on the south wall. He will say, 'What is it I have in there?' You'll say, 'Could it be some bumblebees?' He'll laugh and say, 'No. Maybe some butterflies, the small yellow kind. Maybe some tiny black ants,' you'll say. 'No.' Kaupata will be smiling then. 'This is it,' he'll say. 'But this is the last time, grandson. You say, maybe you have Orion in there.' And then everything, his clothing, his beads, his heart, and the rain clouds, will be yours.'" "Okay, Grandma, I'll go." He took the medicine into the Zuni Mountains. He left the trail and walked high on one of the peaks. The black ducks rushed at him, but he blew the medicine on them before they could squawk. He came up behind the gambler, practicing with the sticks on the floor of his house.
"I'm fasting," he told Kaupata when he offered him the blue cornmeal, "but thanks anyway." Sunman pulled out his things. 4 sets of new clothes, 2 pairs of new moccasins, 2 strings of white shell beads.
Kaupata smiled when he saw these things.
"We'll gamble all night," he said. It happened just the way Spider Woman said. When he had lost everything, Kaupata gave him a last chance. The gambler bet everything he had that Sun Man couldn't guess what he had in the bag on the east wall. Kaupata was betting his life that he couldn't guess what was in the sack hanging from the south wall.
"Heheya. You guessed right.
Take this black flint knife, Sun Man. Go ahead. Cut out my heart. Kill me." Kaupata lay down on the floor with his head toward the east. But Sun Man knew Kaupata was magical, and he couldn't be killed anyway. Kaupata was going to lie there and pretend to be dead. So Sun Man knew what to do. He took the flint blade and he cut out the gambler's eyes. He threw them into the south sky, and they became the horizon stars of autumn. Then he opened the doors of the 4 rooms and he called to the storm clouds.
"My children," he said, "I have found you. Come on out. Come home again. Your mother, the earth, is crying for you. Come home, children. Come home."
"What are you doing here?"
The voice came from the yard. She was standing under an apricot tree, partially hidden by a bushy canopy of gnarled limbs sweeping so close to the earth, the slender leaves touched the ground in the wind. The shadows made her skin and hair look dark. "I couldn't drive past the washed-out bridge, so I left the truck there and rode the horse." The sun had gone down behind the mesa below the rimrock. The sky and clouds on the horizon were bright red.
"Who sent you?"
"I'm looking for some cattle. They belong to my uncle."
"Somebody sent you," she said.
And he noticed she was holding a small willow staff, slightly curved at one end. A cool wind blew down from the northwest rim of the mountain plateau above them and rattled the apricot leaves. He got off the mare and loosened the cinch. The horse tried to shake off sweat and fatigue. The leather and steel fittings on the saddle and bridle clashed together violently. She stepped out from under the tree then. She was wearing a man's shirt tucked into a yellow skirt that hung below her knees. Pale buckskin moccasins reached the edge of her skirt. The silver buttons on the side of each moccasin had rainbirds carved on them. She wasn't much older than he was, but she wore her hair long, like the old women did, pinned back in a knot.
"Can I get some water for the horse?"
She gestured with her chin in the direction of the corral. Her eyes slanted up with her cheekbones like the face of an antelope dancer's mask.
"Help yourself," she said.
Her skin was light brown. She had ochre eyes. She stood in the yard and watched him lead the mare away. The wind was blowing harder, and the mare's long tail streamed around them like tall dune grass. The corral gate bumped back and forth in the wind. The mare was thirsty. She sank her nostrils under water and came up only to breathe. He rubbed her behind the ears where the bridle made sweaty creases in the hair. He smelled leather, wet with horse sweat, and damp clay from the edge of the pool where the mare stood knee-deep. He smelled winter coming in the wind. He tied the horse in the corral and pulled off the saddle. He untied his bedroll from the back of the saddle and looked for a sandy, sheltered place to unroll his bed. The wind and sand were blowing so hard he didn't hear her walk up from behind. He turned, and she was there.
"Come inside,"
she said, loud enough to be heard over the wind. She pulled the hand-woven blanket up around her shoulders and head and walked into the stinging sand with her head bowed. He followed her with his head down and his eyes squeezed shut against the sand.
But he didn't miss the designs woven across the blanket in four colors. Patterns of storm clouds in white and gray. Black lightning scattered through brown wind. He followed her down the long screen porch to a narrow pine door. When she opened it, he smelled dried apricots and juniper wood burning. The inner walls were massive, and all the doorways were low. The smell of clay and mountain sage stirred old memories. He touched a whitewashed wall as he went through a doorway and rubbed the powdery clay between his fingers. His heart was beating fast, and his hands were damp with sweat. The fireplace was in the corner of the room. The flames blazed up, snapping the kindling and sucking at the wind that came down the chimney. He stood in front of the fire and held out his hands to get warm. "Sit down. Eat."